Jerome, g'day. How are you?
Yeah, good, Annie. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to hear from you because you've written an article for Red Flag about your journey up to, I'll say it correctly, hopefully, Mumtui? How do you say it?
Mbatwa.
Mbatwa.
that's what the local Arrernte people, that's the name of the place where Alice Springs is.
Yeah.
It's pretty widely used.
Mbatwa. Is that how you say it? Say it again.
Mbatwa.
Mbatwa.
I'm pretty sure. Something
yeah,
like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. It was completely different from the way I saw it as it was spelled. And that just goes to show how much work needs to be done to understand the languages from this continent. But tell us about your journey up there.
Yeah, well, look, I was only in Alice Springs for a week, so really, in that sort of time, I'm chasing around people. Because of the whole national political storm, which has been happening around Alice Springs, just trying to get a read on what Aboriginal people are saying about that and responses to it. So really, people can read the article where I quote pretty extensively from a series of the Aboriginal and especially Arrernte, the local people who are the traditional owners of Alice Springs, of Mbatwa, what they had to say about it. I suppose in brief, every day and every hour I spent in that place, I became more and more convinced that what we were seeing on screens, on TV screens and, social media and whatnot from the centre of Australia over the last month or so is just a glimmer of a massive economic and social crisis which has gripped many Aboriginal communities in central Australia, both in Alice Springs, in Mbatwa, on the sort of outskirts, in the town camps, and probably more profoundly in the remote communities, which, might be 100 or 200 or 300 kilometres from Alice Springs. And that social crisis isn't just something that happened to happen. It didn't just, fall from the sky mysteriously. This is a crisis which has been brewing for many years. What Aboriginal people repeatedly told me was you want the immediate cause of all of this, what's happening in Alice Springs today? Look at the intervention. Look at the Northern Territory intervention that was launched by the coalition government back in 2007 and then strengthened and deepened and extended by the incoming Labor government when it came in 2000 at the end of 2007 and then presided over by the Liberal government more recently. And there's actually a lot of elements of that intervention which still continue. One of the central elements of the intervention was really demolishing the economic foundation of a lot of remote Aboriginal communities by destroying the Community Development Employment Program. And there's, I grew up in became politically active in the 80s where there was a left-wing critique of the CDEP saying, it shouldn't be, that a lot of the work that was done under the CDEP was essential work for those communities. It should be paid not just the basic award wage, it should be paid higher wages, there should be superannuation, there should be, full-time employment for those who wanted it. So you can make those criticisms of the CDEP, but it wasn't those criticisms that motivated the Howard government and then the Rudd government's demolition of the CDEP. It was instead ripping a huge amount of money out of Aboriginal communities and putting people who had been on the CDEP, on a much lower income, which was basically the dole. So you've ripped billions of dollars. The government quite consciously ripped billions of dollars out of some of the poorest communities in the country, and then proceeded to, at the same time, demolished local sort of governance structures. A lot of these remote communities had community government committees or councils, which, decided, okay, this is the work we need done, this is how we're going to allocate the CDEP money, You know, here's local issues in the town that need to be discussed. All of that was either destroyed or bypassed by Northern Territory and federal governments over many years. That hasn't come back. The CDEP hasn't come back. And the result of that and, you know, the many other changes, policy changes in the intervention, you know, weakening Aboriginal title to land, attacking the idea of perpetual Aboriginal title in various ways, making it easier for mining companies and other developers to sort of step in and to push through development proposals. The result of all of that has been, and still is, a very profound crisis indeed.
The thing is, I like to point out to people something in particular that they can relate to in the Victorian context. One of my sisters has always worked in social welfare, and she pointed out that after the Kennett demolishing of the social services system in Victoria, it all came out in the wash 20 years later. And this is exactly what's going on. The intent, it worked, what he did worked the way he wanted it to, and what happened with the intervention worked the way the capitalist system wanted it to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And many of them, people can read the interview, for instance, with in my article with Q Nakamura Kenny, who's an Aboriginal woman, grew up in Hermannsburg or Intaria, 100 or so kilometres out of Alice Springs. And she says, look, the intervention worked. It was a definite plan, and it worked, like to plunge Aboriginal communities into crisis.
Into chaos.
Yeah, that's right. And there's no shortage of Aboriginal people who have been saying over that entire time, that is what you are doing. And now, you know, there's all this shock horror at the actual results of that, which, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, like, a lot of the media coverage has definitely been sensationalised. I've seen things on the TV where, you know, we're meant to be spooked by nothing more than a group of young Aboriginal people walking through the town. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, like there's a bunch of sort of hype around it. But underneath that, according to the Northern Territory Police, like at one stage when I was up there, they were saying, look, we think it's a core group of about 60 or 80 young people who, you know, are engaging in damaging behaviours and are entering a cycle of criminalisation. And no one I talked to up there was sort of, you know, in denial about the things that were happening in the town. It was just, everyone was scathing at the idea that it can be simplified to, oh, well, you know, it was just the lifting of some of the alcohol restrictions in June of last year. They say, okay, that might have accelerated the crisis or sharpened it or made it more visible, but the roots of the crisis are much deeper.
Well, you know, the thing about, I find the grog thing, you know, the banning of alcohol, a really fascinating white obsession. Because if you look at the statistics, fewer Aboriginal people drink than in percentage terms than the white population, right? Now, that's just actually a fact. I don't know what it's like in central Australia, but the point is that it's really there to emphasise an ongoing mantra that white colonialist society loves to hold dear, like a dolly going to bed, right?
Yeah, and like Kumali Riley, who was one of the people I talked to, was really scathing about this whole narrative of alcohol. And she just, like, you know, reading the quote that she gave me, alcohol is not the problem, it's the system that fails us.
Yeah.
Educate us and empower us and give us self-determination. It's like being in a pressure cooker. And, you know, she goes on to say the alcohol plays a role in that pressure coming out, and bang, it's like a volcano, and the wider community don't know how to control it, and that they fail to include Aboriginal people in, you know, how to deal with, you know, any of the problems. But just to to make alcohol the start and the finish of the problems is incredibly misleading, and I agree with you, actually racist as well.
Yeah, I think it is.
Into a whole,
well, because on my investigation, actually, it's not the preferred drug. And when you talk about 60 to 80 young people marauding, from having chatted to the person who runs Karma up there, they're being indiscriminate about who they break and enter into. Like it's not white, it's not black, it's dispossession we're talking here.
Yeah, exactly. And the flip side of that, like there's no shortage of Aboriginal people who know exactly what the problems are and who have been and are working their guts out to address those problems.
Yeah.
Like one of the examples I have highlighted in the article is an organisation called Children's Ground, and they're, as the name implies, they're the early childhood education organisation, but they have a whole bunch of community development that happens around there. So it's like, okay, let's establish a culturally appropriate childcare program where, kids are taken out on country. They have one nutritious meal a day, every single day. So as a family, they have, they're taken out on country, have a whole education about what different things are called. And all of a sudden, it's that sort of program which then you create a community around. Let's call a community meeting here. How is this program going? How could it be strengthened? What are the challenges it faces? How can we address that as a community? And that approach is stunningly effective. Like I have the example in my article of a young, which they document, that's very well documented, a young girl who's largely nonverbal, who as soon as she gets out on country and there's a whole discussion about bird life and so on, all of a sudden there's something that she actually wants to talk about and is doing it in her own language. And the figures that they've got, with over 3 years, the families that they work with, the engagement with formal education went up from 12% of those families engaged with formal education to something like 82%. So, for 40 years, longer, in fact, Aboriginal people in Central Australia and elsewhere have been saying, look, we want to be able to walk in both worlds, it's quite possible to do that. The only problem with that is that, in my opinion, and, shared by many people in Central Australia, healthy, happy, strong communities with a strong tie to country, this is the last thing that any government wants, in my opinion, in Australia, despite their what they say, because that has proved to be an obstacle for mining development, for gas development. 85% of the landmass of the Northern Territory right now is covered by applications for exploration projects for gas. There is Beetaloo is the most advanced. There is a massive program of mining expansion behind that. That's not the only agenda with the intervention, but certainly, the attempted demolition and weakening of so many communities has certainly assisted that agenda. Communities which are living in poverty have fewer options just economically to say no than communities which are strong, happy, healthy, economically strong as well, and have a strong connection to their country.
Well, you're kinder than I am, because I established in my litany of thought that all Aboriginal legislation in Australia is actually about mining.
I think there are a few other agendas. Like, it's offensive to the neoliberal sort of political establishment. The idea that you should just have a right, that you shouldn't have to be able, you shouldn't have to spend money to access essential services.
Like, yeah, that's right.
The whole idea of Aboriginal land under the Northern Territory Land Rights Act is that this land should be for the collective benefit and enjoyment and use of Aboriginal people forever.
Yeah.
And so that takes it out of the market, you know, the fact that communities can't be swindled out of it, or some entrepreneurial board can't leverage, you know, that land and lose it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, like...
Because one of the things they did was actually cut water and electricity because it wasn't economic in South Australia.
Yeah, and I'd heard of this, and a lot of people listening to the show would have been involved in the enormous protests that happened in 2015 in Melbourne and pretty much every other city around Australia, when Tony Abbott, the then Prime Minister, said, look, he described Aboriginal connection to country as a quote-unquote lifestyle choice, and said that, we can't afford to fund that anymore. And there were huge protests in response to this racist remark. What I didn't realise until I got to Alice Springs was that the precedent for that, the immediate precedent for that, was in 2014, the year before, when one of the town camps around Alice Springs had its water cut off by Bess Price, the political player in Alice Springs and in Central Australia, and the mother of Jacinta Price, the Country Liberal Party senator from the Northern Territory. People can follow the links in the article on Red Flag that I wrote. There's pictures there of the conditions that Aboriginal people are living in, literally just three and a half kilometres from the well-watered green lawns of Central Alice Springs and the shopping malls and air conditioning and all of that. You have Aboriginal people, including senior traditional owners of Mbatwa, of the land on which Alice Springs is built, living in unlined tin shacks in Australia in 2023. And, it's such a mystery why things aren't all sweetness and light in the streets of Alice Springs. It's just, it should be a national disgrace.
Just on the very sheer practicalities of that, as you were saying, that the first building on the southern outskirts of the town is the prison, and that Bill Yarn, the former CEO of the prison, is now one of the local members of the NT government.
Yeah, which tells you something about the strength of law and order politics in that part of the world. Bill Yarn was... looking at the election figures, it was a pretty narrow win that he got. It wasn't this decisive, thumping win, but the fact that a law and order agenda can have a lot of appeal, both to white residents of Alice Springs, and also it has to, looking at the figures, there were remote communities which voted pretty solidly for him as well, which... Anyway, there'd be a whole story about that. But,
It's about they want peace.
Yeah, and the fact that these communities, many of these communities, have been plunged into crisis for years under Labor governments as well as Liberal,
as Jeremy, it's this English idea that if you beat people into submission, then you'll get a positive outcome, when in actual fact, as you've pointed out, this isn't the way. There are lots of evidence of how you can have happy, strong community. They just don't want a strong and happy community amongst our First Nations people in Central Australia.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, further on that, I think every non-Aboriginal person, has to realise that we have an interest in this as well. We live in a society where, we're told, we can't, that these remote communities are unsustainable and should be stripped of, what limited economic assistance that they have. This is the same political establishment that celebrates, a $200 billion nuclear submarine deal. Oh, that's meant to be sustainable. $9 billion per year shoveled to fossil fuel companies in subsidies by Liberal and Labor governments. We're told that that's sustainable. But Aboriginal people living on their land, that's not sustainable. Decent wages, also not sustainable. A healthcare system that's not in crisis. Oh, sorry, that's just not sustainable.
Self-determination.
So unless you're a billionaire, I think you have, a pretty decent interest in standing with Aboriginal people when they say, well, The only thing that's not sustainable is the system that's been imposed on Aboriginal people and on the rest of us as well, quite frankly.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Jerome.
Thanks, Seth, for the opportunity. And, yeah, check out the article on Red Flag. Follow the links. There's plenty more information there. And thanks, Seth, for the opportunity, Annie. And talk soon, I hope.
Yeah.